I'm Scott Denton, Thursday alternate freeform host, and I have the pleasure of having Nels Klein, guitarist, composer, band leader, tireless collaborator, and lead guitarist, of course, of the band Wilco, who will be appearing in Santa Fe on September 26th. Nels, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
To do the catch-up for this chat and look over your recent projects, things that I didn't necessarily know about or things you had planned, I think I started to have an anxiety attack. I can't believe, you know, so it's really, you know, the cliche of thanks for taking time out of a busy schedule to speak with us is not a cliche at all in this, in these circumstances. It's a remarkable whirlwind of things that you've got going on. Why don't we start with tomorrow begins a week-long residency at the Stone East Village Performance Space that's owned by John Zorn.
Well, this is going to be the easiest Stone residency, the third and maybe my final one. The Stone in that location is going to close next year in the spring, but now they just do one show at 8:30, so it'll be six different concerts starting tomorrow, whereas it used to be 12 in six nights. So
right, two shows a night.
Well, two different shows.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, so I would do 12 different things as we do, the people who've been able to do it. So this is only six, so it seems kind of easy.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah.
But it's going to be really fun because it's primarily going to be me experimenting with various improvising ensembles or duos, which is just a privilege and an honor, really, and I'm really looking forward to it.
So will all of these performances be improv?
I have some music written for my group called the Ring Nebula Project, which is Friday night. That's with Michael T.A. Thompson on drums, Chris Lightcap on bass, Taylor Hobynum on brass instruments, and Dave Rempis on alto saxophone visiting from Chicago. And other than that, I think it's all improvised performances. Even Julian Lage and I, who have a duo wherein we play compositions, are going to improvise our set on Sunday night. I do have some structural parameters that I will sort of direct by means of things written down on heavy cardstock for my dobro and banjo sextet on Saturday night.
Yeah, I was marveling at, well, really at all the collaborators. I just picked up, there's a new, or maybe it's not that new to me anyway, a record by Elliot Sharp, Mary Halverson, and Mark Rebo.
No, I don't even know about this.
Yeah, I just discovered it recently, so I believe it's a recent release, certainly this year. Well,
wow.
you can ask them about it on Saturday
I'm gonna
night.
I'm going to have to.
So Elliot Sharp, Mary Halverson, Julian Lage, and yourself, guitarists.
Well, it's also Joel Harrison, who replaced Brandon Seabrook, who was unable to do it, and Julian. So we're all playing resonator guitars or banjo.
That's got to be wild. Now, is this a totally new project?
It's totally new. It was just something. In a way, I don't want to bum on the fact that Brandon couldn't make it, but I kind of was expecting Elliot and Brandon to sort of be the torchbearers of shred.
Yeah.
Particularly, of course, Brandon has the most insane technique, but it was just an excuse to see what a lot of, and I love resonator guitar, the banjo factor was going to come from Brandon, but also it turns out that Joel and Elliot will be bringing banjos. But just these kinds of timbres with structured improvisation fascinates me, and I just thought it would be, I guess in some ways, slightly perverse to try to do something like this, but it just seemed like a good idea. And then interestingly,
yeah,
or even
like
perhaps ironically, Joel Harrison did a dobro ensemble already earlier this year, although his was probably much more structured and maybe had some elements, I don't know, I haven't asked him, of what one might term the sort of syntax or the vocabulary of the dobro, which I will be eschewing in my sextet.
That sounds,
I don't think we'll be playing any country or blues licks.
No, I didn't imagine. I just when I was looking over the residency, that certainly did not occur to me. Even though, you know, that's one of your homes. We know that. I mean, with Wilco and so forth. But a lot of these people, of course, your wife Yuka on Yuka Honda on Tuesday night with Ikui Mori and Eric Friedlander.
Yeah.
Now, Eric Friedlander and Zena Parkins, who you're going to work with on Wednesday, who's a harpist. A lot of these folks are people that have played on your album Lovers from last year.
Well, that's pretty crazy. That whole ensemble is crazy. I can't believe I even got to make that record, let alone the people that got to play with the people who played on it. You know, it's crazy.
Right, in those just two shows, right, in April in Los Angeles and San Francisco.
Yeah, we also just did, we first played it last summer at Newport Jazz Festival. We played it at 11:30 in the morning. And then, we did two shows last April in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and we just played a little over a week ago in Prospect Park here in Brooklyn, where I live, and that was pretty amazing.
I bet 17 or so folks on stage.
Yeah, I think it was only 16 because, regrettably, Zena Parkins was doing her week at the Stone that week.
No,
and I just didn't even get a harpist.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine anyone but you. But you know, Zena's work, as you could probably understand.
Yeah.
And we are going to do four concerts in Europe this fall with local musicians, but we'll be importing the rhythm section and Michael Leonard, my esteemed arranger and conductor.
Great. We'll come back and talk about Lovers in a minute or something, but then
okay.
I wanted to run through some of the projects that are anybody who's listening to this and their eyes are glassing over, and you can always go to nelsklein.com and kind of get the rundown of all this.
The most stale website on the internet, but
well,
my calendar is current.
Exactly. So that's the main thing. These projects, I was fascinated because I didn't know anything. I was definitely a fan of experimental and avant-garde so-called music and everything. So, I don't know if you know about the recent tribute album to Pauline Oliveros. And,
I don't know about this record. I know about it, but I haven't heard it.
Yeah, exactly. Last Sense to Leave Us is the title of it. And Tala McDonough contributes. And, of course, I was fascinated to read about Molecular Affinity.
Right. Well, Tala put that together. And Lord knows there were so many collaborations that I've been able to participate in that I never thought I would do. And certainly I never thought I would do any music with Pauline Oliveros. But you know, Tollum got Pauline really interested in this idea of us recording some trio improvisations. So we got together up in Accord, New York, a very, very small town in upstate New York, in a studio in a barn that was quite lovely, and just had this fantastic afternoon, which eventually was edited and mixed to be, I guess, what is probably the first posthumous release that she played on. Certainly that wasn't what was planned.
Right, no. And because
The record was delayed because of problems with the pressings. It's just a vinyl release, and there were some problems with the pressing and mastering or something. And then she passed away.
So suddenly.
Yeah. But you know what? Wow. That's how I want to go.
Oh, I know.
Because Wilco had just been in Utrecht. It was last November at a festival there, and she was performing at the same festival, but about 4 or 5 days later, I think, then we were there and we were on tour, so we were long gone. And it was just a few days after she was there that she went home and passed away in her sleep.
Right.
And boy, that's the way to go. She
yeah.
was already she was touring, man.
Exactly. Yeah. Had you met her before making this recording?
Nope.
Mm-hmm.
Nope.
She'd turn out to be as amazing as I would think. You know, just in terms of spiritual and philosophical kind of.
She was super relaxed. I mean, she was just relaxed and trying to listen and react to the music. And she was just completely warm and supportive and relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it wasn't a heavy thing at all in a kind of personal, person to person way. It was like playing with somebody who really knows what they're doing. And
I mean,
she was completely cool.
And had been doing it for, 70 or 60 years or so, at least.
Just in many different phases, fascinating, layer after layer of exceptionally visionary work.
Absolutely. A real pioneer. So that vinyl record is self-titled Molecular Affinity?
No, it's just our three names, and Molecular Affinity is the title of the record.
Okay.
And it was kind of my idea to call it Molecular Affinity as a follow-up to the trio I did with Tallon and Michael Wimberly, which they decided should be called Radical Empathy.
Mm-hmm.
So the two album titles, both trios of improvised music, are, I guess, in that way, to me, they're related.
Sort of bookends. Cool. And then your brother, your twin brother, Alex, has Ocean of Vows, came out in March.
Right. The little two compact discs in a nice, fancy box. It's a very, very ambitious and moving work.
I'm looking forward to hearing it. I just got that, too, recently, and I hadn't been aware of it. I was a month or two behind or so, but I look forward to that. And that's composed music, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, of course, we get to improvise within limits or parameters. But no, he's a composer, and it's very, very well thought out. It's very dramatic at times, and it's a large ensemble. I believe it's 13 people.
And it is sort of takes its inspiration from a Buddhist sutra?
Yes, I guess it's, not knowing anything about Buddhist sutras, it's one of the most, I guess, beloved and analyzed and elaborate or layered, or I don't know how
sure.
to describe it,
right.
But yes.
And I was interested to read that Thich Nhat Hanh has been Alex's teacher.
Yes.
And this was sort of a birthday or a so-called continuation gift.
Exactly.
And,
yeah, he performed it live as part of the Angel City Jazz Festival prior to recording it. And then we spent 2 days recording it, and it was really fun. And I was home in my hometown, you know, that was...
Right.
And with Yuka, it was really, really enjoyable.
You guys have lived in Brooklyn now for, what, since 2010 or so? Or?
Yes, I've been here since then. Yuka has been in New York since 1986.
Right, right.
But we were living in the West Village until late last year, and now we're in Prospect Heights, Brooklyn.
Of course, listeners may know Yuka Honda as one of the founders of Chibo Matto, I guess. Are they over? Are they done with that project?
Well, they put out a really cool record, I guess, about 3 years ago now called Hotel Valentine, and we did some touring with and without guitar. But I think perhaps yes.
I think I must have recalled reading when that record came out that it was the last one, at least for the time being. And then,
well, I don't think that was the plan. Seems to me it possibly worked out that way.
Well, yeah. And then you've got Big Walnuts Yonder with Mike Watt, Nick Reinhardt.
Oh,
and,
that's out. Yeah, that came out on Sargent House. Came out in June, I believe.
So
it could have been May.
And Greg Saunier from Deerhoof.
Yep.
So the four.
Nick Reinhardt on guitar.
And
yeah, it's a really fun record. I really like it.
How would you describe it?
Well, it's kind of all over the place, but the gist of it is it's very guitar centric, I guess. And Nick ended up putting vocals on a lot of the songs, and then ended up asking Watt to do some vocals on a couple of songs. So that took the whole thing in a different direction. I thought we were making an instrumental record when we recorded it. It was 3 days of recording in Brooklyn in Tony Mamone's studio, in Studio G, and it was really, really cool. A really lovely 3 days of collaboration and construction, I would say. And it sounds super tight.
I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. I really, really like the way it came out.
Uh-huh. You've probably known Mike Watt since the L.A. punk days.
Well, I didn't know him back then. I was just a Minutemen fan. I met him at the end of the Firehose days, was when we actually spoke. I did open for the Minutemen when I was playing with Charlie Hayden's Liberation Music Orchestra West Coast at McCabe's Guitar Shop in the 80s. But I didn't chat with the Minutemen. I just sort of worshiped them.
Yeah. Yeah, Mike Watt has remained. I saw him here in New Mexico a few years back with, I can't remember what they were calling themselves, the two Italian gentlemen to they were.
Oh,
a
yeah,
trio.
I can never remember the name of that band either.
Yeah, and amazing.
Yeah, they were. I saw them. Yuka and I went to go hear them at the Mercury Lounge when they were here about a year ago or so ago, and that was really fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And then you've got Ibone with Jim Black and Elias.
Oh yeah,
Stemesetter. Am I pronouncing
Stemesetter?
Stemesetter.
Yeah, Stemesetter. Well, that's. I mean, it's finished. I don't know how it's going to come out, but I think it's going to emerge at some point. And that's there are compositions involved by Elias and Jim, and it's a really good rockin' record. I'm curious to see what happens with that.
And Nels Klein IV, so Julian Lage, yourself, mm-hmm. Scott Colley, and Tom Rainey, yet another.
Yeah, we've started recording. We have a record. We're trying to get a record out by spring of next year. So that's in the works, mm-hmm. as is a new singer's record, which is going to be the Nels Klein Singers Unlimited, mm-hmm. which will be an expanded band with Scott Amendola, Trevor Dunn, Cyril Baptista, Brian Masella on keyboard.
Wow.
I'm going to ask Zena to play on it, and I'm going to ask Yuka to do some production and overdubs and some various electronic contributions.
It'll be the first Nels Klein Singers album that isn't the three of you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there are guests on all our records except mm-hmm. the first one. Greg Saunier does a little vocal turn on the Giant Pin, Glenn Cochi, and also John Bryan is on that record on some keyboards. Glenn Cochi's on Draw Breath as a guest. And the last record we did, Macroscope, had Ciro on most of the records, Ciro Baptista.
Mm-hmm.
And Zena's on it, and so yeah. But it'll be officially bigger.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And also Scott Amendola and I are going to be doing some duo recording next month, in anticipation of some duo gigs we have next year.
Okay, now let's come back to Lovers. Your album that you have talked about had this idea germinating for 25 years or so of a song that captures a notion, not the notion. The most commonly held notion, but notion of mood music, and the aside from some originals of your own, the range here is typical Nels Klein. I mean, it's vast, from Richard Rodgers to Arta Lindsay to Jimmy Giuffre and to Sonic Youth.
Right.
Anybody who's already a Nels Klein fan, they won't be surprised by that. Somebody else might wonder.
Yeah.
So, what else would you say?
Like, what the hell's up with this?
Well, I wouldn't phrase it that way, because I adore the album, and it's so broad.
A lot of thought went into it, obviously, I guess. Too much, possibly. And I maybe have painted myself into a corner by uttering the term mood music, but it did come from my, I guess, not overt love of mood music records, because I don't really have a love of mood music records. What I have is a love of the idea of mood music records, which is the idea of putting on any record, whether it's Stan Getz Focus or you know, Persuasive Percussion or something, in order to create an atmosphere of or an ambience of intimacy, relaxed kind of closeness, romance, something. So the original idea of Lovers, as it came to me in the 80s, was to make a record that was orchestrated and that was maybe, you know, live performances such as Stan Getz Focus or, you know, Miles Davis Sketches of Spain or something like that.
Sure.
And have it be darker or more honest in terms of romance or in terms of love, mm-hmm. you know. In other words, all different shades and permutations. And maybe some of the, I guess, darker is the polite word, sides of that equation would be represented in a more contemporary way. And so that was the original idea of the record. As the years progressed and I, you know, wrote songs, took them off the list, pondered cover songs, expanded the list, took songs off, put songs on, this went on forever. My life was progressing. And as it progressed, I think the record became less dark, as perhaps did my psyche. So yeah, as my life progressed and I changed in mm-hmm. some regards, perhaps, I don't know. I didn't really think about it until I realized that we were really going to have to do this record because David Breskin had figured out sort of funding strategy. And along with Angel City Arts and the Shifting Foundation, we ended up being able to make this record. And with the help of Michael Leonard, who I met through my wife Yuka, who was our neighbor in the West Village, he said, please let me help you with this record. And he's an expert arranger, and I was so daunted. I was always going to do all the arrangements myself.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, that was the original idea. And my arrangement ideas, which I'd had for a long time, were for specific pieces that were on the list from the very beginning, such as Cry Want by Jimmy Giuffre, the two pieces by Annette Peacock. Actually, originally Touching was going to be the only one, but I wanted to add So Hard It Hurts as the only reference, or I don't know, I guess reference is the best word, to the violent side of intimacy and sexuality. But it's brief, so I wanted I didn't really want to linger on that. But I felt that that was also a way to represent yet another brilliant Annette Peacock composition. Pieces like that, Secret Love, which has this strange polychord heartbeat, 5/8 pattern against 4, things like that were in my mind for a long time, but arrangements on my own pieces and on standards like Beautiful Love or I Have Dreamed, I had no skill to do what Michael did on those pieces whatsoever. So the stuff that you hear that you might term on Lovers as the weirder stuff, that's probably Michael perfectly executing and beyond anything I had dreamed, my ideas.
Sure.
And then if you hear something like Beautiful and you have these classic voicings and these beautiful backs while I'm soloing or whatever, this is all Michael Leonard's work and something that I'm pretty sure I could not have done. So anyway, by the time we were really doing it, I realized that this record was not nearly as dark as I thought it was going to be. And I'm pleased. It's also much longer than it was ever intended to be, because it was never going to be a double record. But David and Michael both said, hey, man, let's just do it all, see where it lands.
Sure.
You know? Once I started assembling the whole thing, it actually became, in its own way, almost autobiographical, and also became a narrative, like a timeline of musical endeavor and musical influence on me, and layered homage to various musicians whom I admire. And it was like a little puzzle also to put it together to fit onto double vinyl, because the sides have to be of a certain length. And it really worked out. It wasn't even as hard as it sounds, which was surprising to me, to be honest. I thought I was going to be laboring over this, but it actually kind of fit together, well, I wouldn't say logically, but almost logically. And I just couldn't be happier.
And you had written somewhere too, along with the sort of these binaries of love and intimacy, or intimacy and romance, etc. One that really intrigued me, and I think is probably kind of a something that's been with you throughout your entire career as a musician and a composer, and that is the relationship between sound and song.
Right. Well, I really want to say I'm like a total song guy, but I'm really a sound guy. To be able to explore sound within the context of a record that is songs, quite often been written about already as containing, you know, the so-called American songbook, none of these things that they've written I'd never thought about, really. I just wanted it to reflect my own taste, I guess, and also the lyrics to the songs that have lyrics were important. That's why they're printed in the package, because it's a concept album. So as such, in order to explore the emotional dimensions or possibilities, to me, I have to explore sound, not just blow over chord changes, which I do, yes, because it's a jazz record mostly. Whatever jazz means, that's kind of what it is. And though I'm no ambassador of jazz, certainly I'm not like a real jazz musician in the sense of my depth of knowledge of improvisational abilities, nor of the actual songbook itself. I wanted to at least honor that discipline and that aesthetic. But at the same time, in order to elucidate the emotional implications of pieces like So Hard It Hurts or the night theme from The Night Porter, I felt that we had to go into sound and texture and timbre investigations and within parameters, within limits.
Sure.
In order to create atmosphere, not to create novelty, in order to amplify why those pieces were there, what I was trying to communicate. That's an area where I'm very comfortable. You know, I'm certainly less comfortable playing a fantastic guitar solo over, you know, chord changes on Beautiful Love or something, but I did my best, and such is that life, you know.
Well, and both of those worlds, that's a nice segue to Wilco, because obviously the improvisational world that you inhabit and that you said is perhaps your first love, that is one.
I don't know if it's my first love, but I feel confident in that world. It's more natural, perhaps. You know, when Zena Parkins and I get together and improvise and we go into that sound world, or if I'm lucky enough to get together with Fred Frith, which as I've done a couple of times, and we start improvising, we go into that sound world place where we don't need to be thinking about really anything except the moment and the sound and what's working and what it sounds like and what it feels like.
Yeah.
So I feel confident to be able to go to those places, to be open and to react and listen and use my vocabulary to participate in that kind of endeavor. Everything else for me, which is what most people would term regular old music, is pretty hard. You know, it's not the easiest thing for me to play songs and sound good and all that stuff that great musicians do. So,
well, you manage.
But to add all these elements together is certainly something I aspire to, because I believe in all these different kinds of ways of making music.
Yes.
And whether it's what we call sound or song, to bring them all together, and also to bring styles and schools of thought and generations together, is a pretty lovely thing. And that's what Lovers is about. It became strangely autobiographical, but also it represents my kind of aesthetic ideal, I guess you would say, which is the merging or the confluence or the harmony between seemingly disparate musical entities or schools of thought or approaches.
Yeah, and that's what makes your music, the broad palette of it, so interesting in so many ways. We spoke 5 years ago when Wilco played Santa Fe, and I made the comment, because I had been aware of you before you joined Wilco. We were talking a lot about John McLaughlin, of course, and your admiration of him.
Yes.
And I think I said something like, when I heard that Nels Klein was going to join Wilco, it was as if back when Brian Jones was replaced, if the Stones had hired John McLaughlin. So somebody coming into a rock band. Now, of course, you had a rock past with Geraldine Fibbers, and you know you had inhabited that world in the L.A. scene and everything, along with the free jazz. That was perhaps what you were more known for back in, you know, 30 years or so ago. So you came to Wilco bringing that kind of, bringing all of this sensibility. So 13 years on now, with the Wilco lineup stabilized from 2004 going forward, and I try to catch the tours when they come near me, and I mean this in all seriousness. I've been surprised that I could find the band sounding better than the last time I saw them. And that seems to still be going on, at least from a...
Wow, that's good to hear. But I have to say, I mean, maybe it has something to do with the fact that we love what we do and we're really, really happy doing it. You know, I mean, we really enjoy each other's company and we enjoy the music and we give it our all. And to me, otherwise I couldn't do it. You know, I mean, why would I do this? It's satisfying in a way that I would never have predicted in 2004 when I joined. I just thought it would be interesting or challenging or, you know, see where this goes. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And I kind of needed rescuing in that way back then, just so I could keep playing guitar instead of going back to, you know, another 18 years of day jobs or whatever. But no, it's certainly informed in some ways, I think, the music I do now in surprising ways, or maybe it's only surprising to me. Certainly, I've been asked enough times, like, what do you think the impact of Wilco is on your own music at this point? And I think I initially thought there probably wouldn't be much impact or that much consideration that I would have to give it. But I think it has had an impact. Certainly it's made me appreciate, along with other people's music as well, but it's kind of really coming from the experiential aspect of playing Wilco music, to come to appreciate a major triad a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
That was not my modus operandi most of my life. It's like, sometimes the obvious thing is the right thing, you know? Sometimes the direct thing is the right thing.
Sure.
And sometimes indirectness mixed with directness, which I would say maybe Jeff Tweedy's sometimes abstruse poetry mixed with the directness of the music is a great thing. Man, I've just learned so much from being around Jeff and his process and his incredible, his prolificity a word?
Mm-hmm.
He's prolific. He's prolific in a great way because songs just like just come out of him, and he doesn't overthink the actual song itself. He may pore over the lyric content and refine it over a period of time, but just a chord progression, the beginning of an idea, some words, a chorus that comes to mind, whatever, it just flows out of him. And
seemingly more effortlessly as he gets older.
I think that before I was in the band, I heard he was insanely prolific. But when I joined the band, he was at a kind of a crossroads. And this was when he went into rehab. And he really got himself together. And as the 13 years have gone by, I think he's definitely at a point now in the last couple of years or 3 years where that prolific thing I'd heard about is in full force again.
It's back.
He's kind of scary in that way. It's amazing. But as an ensemble also, there's just this kind of level of effortless commitment. Like, we're just there for this music, you know? Not something we need to talk about or, I don't know.
When we spoke 5 years ago, I had asked about the band's process. Does Jeff always come in with a finished idea or not? And you actually sort of walked us through how the art of Almost came together.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was a weird one.
Is there something, but it was a great example, is there something from Schmilko or Star Wars that
Now, it's funny you mention this, because now the stuff's way more finished when we get it. I mean, Jeff he'll present a song and he's already played a bunch of guitar parts on it or something. And sometimes these guitar parts are so cool that I just don't want to hear them replaced, you know, so they end up being on the master. And sometimes now live, Pat and I are playing our interpretations of Jeff's guitar parts. There are a lot of Jeff guitars on the last two records. And in a way, I guess what I'm saying is there's nothing really predictable about about a Jeff Tweedy or Wilco song process. So whatever was true 5 years ago is likely not going to be true now, or semi-true.
Right.
It's just, there's no real consistency there other than the fact we'll still be dealing with a bunch of Jeff songs because he has so many songs coming out of them.
Just recently, the band released All Lives You Say, a song which is for the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's on the band camp site, and so folks can go there and make a contribution and download the song. Now, this came out just a couple of days after Charlottesville. My Wilco fan question, of course, is, that wasn't just cobbled together that quickly, was it? Was it something that was sort of on the shelf?
No, I mean, but it's definitely recent, and it's a demo. Certainly, Jeff has been writing songs. One of the things that he endeavored to do when the nightmare of the election result became known, and we were all in Utrecht, in fact, I mentioned Utrecht earlier, when staying up all night and witnessing the nightmare on television in Europe, he started basically writing, I think, a song a day for himself to address his anguish and his dissatisfaction. I don't even know what words to use to describe.
I know.
but Jeff is now assiduously, perhaps obsessively, because he is rather obsessive, pouring over every aspect of what's happening every day, every news agency he can find. I mean, it's actually probably why we're not sound checking as much as we used to. I don't know. I mean, I'm not kidding. But that song came from one of his many, many songs that he has written to deal with what he's going through and this, it's his response, you know, and a very positive one, I would have to say.
I think so, yeah.
To this kind of sense of, God, I don't know, anxiety.
Dread, despair.
Dread. That's a great word. Yeah.
Yes.
So that's what that came from.
I'm interested to have heard that. I think Jeff's not alone, at least I'm with him because I'm doing the same thing. I'm paying attention to DC politics in ways that I certainly never did before. And I know.
But he's always been paying attention. Mm-hmm. I have to say. But now it's almost like this kind of vigilance. It's fiery. Mm-hmm. You know,
you can't even
keep up with what happens.
Exactly.
Every day now. It's insane. I hate to say this. Please, listeners, don't take this wrong. And whatever your political sympathies lie, I was raised by what I might generally term liberal humanist Democrat parents, and both of whom were English and history teachers in the Los Angeles City school system. And certainly they, taught classes in United States history that didn't tell the whole story because people weren't doing that back then, okay? It was
sure.
A long time ago. But they read a lot of books. And they had standards, and they had dreams about where this country could go, where it should go, and that had to do with fairness, a fair dispensation for everyone, and tolerance. I am so glad. I would never have been happier to say that they were not able to see this because they're not alive anymore. I don't even know how they could deal with it. And Okay, let's change the subject.
So that was just the all lives, you say. And it's getting to be your dinner time, so I'll let you go here pretty quick.
I'm in Brooklyn, man. We eat pretty late here.
Okay. You shouldn't have said that. I wanted to segue back to Wilco and just how the intriguing thing, I think, where you're concerned, and I think probably of the other members of Wilco, Glenn Cochi as well, somebody else who has a foot squarely in experimental avant-garde, composition and with his work and so many of his collaborations, those elements of your work and his work bring a huge dimension, I think, to Wilco. And I see the fruit of it in many cases in songs that preceded your arrival in the band. I think Yankee Hotel and Ghost is Born songs in particular, as they're performed, demonstrate a beautiful combination of sound and song, as we were discussing.
I think that Jeff was on this path, certainly with Yankee Hotel Foxtrot and A Ghost is Born, of a kind of combination of songwriterly craft and instrumental exploration. And if you listen to his guitar playing on A Ghost is Born, you know that he's also capable of some fantastic improvisational forays and just basically interested in music in general. I mean, I think that because Wilco gets tagged with this Americana thing, whatever.
Unfortunately.
It's there,
of course, especially from the earlier albums.
But also, Jeff, he knows a lot about songwriting and songwriters, certainly knows a lot about folk music and blues and rock. But what gets overlooked when one labels an endeavor with a kind of a nationalist tag is what inspires the person who creates the music from whatever nation this person lives in. And the fact is that we're all listening to stuff from all over the place. And Jeff is right there with us, if not even beyond me, mm-hmm. in terms of how many things he hears, how many things he's listening to of all different types of disciplines and from all places around the globe. So I think that's something that we should all be taking into account when we start making generalizations about somebody who, it's natural for Jeff to write songs. He writes songs based on chords that are on the guitar, but he's not just listening to guitar and folk and rock and blues music. You know, he's thinking about a lot of other stuff while he is writing songs that are kind of, based on forms that are in his wheelhouse because he's a communicator. You know, the thing that it took me forever to come to in life, because I'm really a sound guy and maybe an improvisation guy and maybe I like really fancy chords, is the directness of the singer-songwriter. It's about creating, in most cases, a kind of familiar structure upon which the voice imparts the melody and the message, and that usually entails something familiar. There's a classic chord progression. There's something apprehendable, if not completely accessible, about the structure upon which one hangs one's poetic vision or confession or whatever it is, you know, that singer-songwriters do. And this is an area in which I am generally clueless.
Yeah.
Because I spent my life looking in other directions. Playing with Wilco has completely changed that, in the sense that I have developed an appreciation and even perhaps some insight into how directness and, I don't mean to say simplicity in a bad way, but a certain kind of simplicity speaks volumes when one tries to communicate one's song. And it's not as somebody who's not a songwriter, this eluded me, you know. I mean, I've tried to write songs before. I was in a band in Los Angeles called Block for years and wrote a fair amount of lyrics for this band, for our singer, Camille Henry, to sing. But I don't consider myself a songwriter, really. That's a different kind of discipline. And it's an art that I am appreciating more at this point in my life than ever. And it's because of my exposure to Jeff's process, to his art, you know, his, like, who he is.
That's really interesting. I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all. I've been an admirer of his from the beginning, from Uncle Tupelo and so forth. But it's a great, succinct overview, if you will, you know, of your evolution and his.
Right.
So it's
kind of funny how long it took me to figure that out.
Last question. You and I, our sensibilities are pretty similar with respect to Crazy Horse to Sonic Youth, you know, and sometimes within the same song, then that's even better. Sound and song,
right,
you know, married beautifully the way they are in so many of the Wilco performances. Are we experiencing a renaissance of avant and popular music crossover? It seems so to me.
Well, I certainly am. I have to tell you that I'm incredibly grateful that we have been able to dissolve certain barriers, maybe not all of them, but certain barriers that were quite an obstacle to the impure, you know, as I've always seen myself. And by that I mean that writers about music in the late 70s, for example, were trying to protect what they called the music, which in this case meant forward-leaning jazz or free jazz, from pop elements.
Mm-hmm.
And by pop elements, I mean like a blues-infused wailing electric guitar or an electric bass or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly times have changed, and a lot is not just allowed but appreciated now. And this changed my life, to be honest, because one could, you know, look at my work and say, like, what is the voice? What is the focus? And I would have to say, I have no idea. I just do what I like, right?
Mm-hmm.
But what I like is all over the place. And all over the place maybe makes more sense now. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that electronic realms, improvised realms, composed realms, rock musicians, not rock musicians, composers, we're all interacting in ways that I would never have dreamt of. You know, certainly here in New York, there's a lot going on, that cross-pollination between different disciplines. Places like National Sawdust, where you have Paolo Prestini looking over and encouraging all kinds of work that's not quote-unquote classical, even though she is considered a contemporary classical composer, and embracing elements of street music, hip-hop, pop, whatever it is, electronica, multimedia. It's happening all over the place. It's
mm-hmm.
what Big Ears is a perfect example.
Yes.
And I also think that, and this is, I don't want to start on a whole new tirade or something, or not a tirade, but a rant. I also think that with the increase of the availability of information, in this case, musical information of the past, not just the present,
mm-hmm.
and seeing how younger generations, people way younger than me, have mm-hmm. not only found but embraced music that I thought no one would ever listen to again until, like, I don't know, if ever,
right,
way after my death. They have found it, appreciated it, analyzed it, probably done doctoral theses on it, you know,
Exactly.
This is nothing but encouraging. This is nothing but inspiring and wonderful. So, I think we're in this kind of strange era of awareness and cross-pollinization where I'm seeing an appreciation of music in a scholarly way and in a just basic enjoyment way that I never anticipated. And it's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
I agree.
And also, I used to have all the suspicion of anybody who wanted to play in a rock band and also play and improvise music or compose was greeted with great suspicion. And I can understand that. That's like a sort of like, you know, circle the wagons, human nature kind of thing. And it still exists, but it doesn't exist to the extent that it used to. And it also is, I don't know if it's, what is it? Is it decadence? I don't think so. I think it's tolerance, and I also think it's awareness. And I also think that it has something to do with technology and with how much history we have now. We have grown. We have grown and learned. And if we could only do this as a nation politically, I would really be happy.
I agree with you completely. I meet millennials, and simply because of the internet, they're music geeks. You've got to kind of have that music geek gene to begin with. The motivation comes from that. But my God, the tools they have now, we learned by word of mouth and foraging in record shops.
Right.
The amount of knowledge and insight that people have that took, you and I, it's taken decades to acquire. They're acquiring it like in their 20s. Yeah. And so it's exciting. And then even in New York City, you know, you go to the Met to see American Ballet Theater, or you go to hear the symphony, and the crowd is on the older side. But ensembles like Brooklyn Rider and, New York's chock full of them, Alarm Will Sound, Why Music, and so on. These are the folks that are going to, I think, save. If it ever needed saving, I don't think Beethoven and Mozart were ever really in danger. But classical music as something classical music.
They have the aristocracy behind them.
That's true, yeah. I think when one does start to worry a little bit about, you know, the future of classical music, for example, let alone the more experimental forms, I think, that I think you put it very well.
Well, I got really alarmed when I heard that the Harry Parch instruments were actually going to be possibly, had no home, that no one knew where they were going to go. And this was just, about a year or two ago. And so I still think that we need a little to learn, and we can't rely on Europe to save us from ourselves.
No.
We need to actually appreciate aspects of our culture that don't fit into tidy little frameworks of, you know, you could call it jazz, or you can call it contemporary classical, or you can call it something. But when it comes down to housing an archive of huge, complicated, and beautiful instruments, like, somebody needs to step up. So we still have a few things to learn, but overall things are kind of marvelous in the way that you have sort of, you know, asked about. That it's a good period. We're in a good period for a lot of creativity. I think that we need to probably, I don't think it's incumbent on artists to be political or to espouse topical opinion or whatever in their work, but I think that we do need to kind of stay aware of the fact that this privilege of being creative and free in our work is a privilege. It can be taken away at any time by a tyrannical society and censorship. So we just need to be vigilant, not get too comfortable. You know, most societies in this world do not have the freedoms that we kind of take for granted at this point. And they just don't.
Yeah.
Even if they say they do, they lie. Their governments lie. So that's of great concern. I feel like the luckiest person alive that I get to do what I do. I get to look forward to my calendar and see amazing things happening all the way into next winter. And I just hope that I can do this work. Mm-hmm. I can do this work without the interruption of some inhumane, you know, horrific event or events. So I just really want to stress that we need creativity and we need art, yes, but we really need our society to thrive and for everybody to feel like participants and that what they do is important no matter what it is they do. We're all important. We're all just part of a whatever society is, whether it's a puzzle or whether it's a miracle or whatever it is. I don't know. But we artists will continue no matter what, but we're really lucky to be experiencing this kind of period that you described, and I just hope it can continue without some horrendous interruption.
Yeah,
you know?
As I was getting into this mode that you talked about, you know, Jeff being in, and so many, I think, you know, we're all doing this now, paying much closer attention to politics and so forth. David Remnick in The New Yorker wrote something that I thought was very apt, but just said that not paying close attention to legislation and things going on, you know, in a government are indeed the privilege of a relatively stable democracy. And what we're experiencing is, so far, it looks like the guardrails are holding and so forth, you know, without getting into a whole other tangent there. But
that's right.
We were never worried about the guardrails and the norms staying put.
Exactly.
Now we have to be, and that may ultimately be a good thing. But regardless, you know, it's a good thing for sure. Yeah.
Because so many societies have had to be, you know, like on guard for just a death squad to show up and like kill an entire family.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? They're just, they're not really thinking about like, hey, what if they burn my poem? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And, you know, I just finished this remarkable book. It's kind of written for the layman, and it's called Temperament: How Music Became a Battleground for the Great Minds of Western Civilization. And okay, you think like, oh, wow, gee, that sounds really fascinating. Well, I mean, I'm being sarcastic.
No, of course.
But it actually is
a
beautiful book written for the layperson about how equal temperament was, how it came to be, essentially. Mm. And it goes hand in hand with what is essentially world history, but more specifically, you know, Western history. But it does incorporate certain things about China and whatnot. But as one reads this, one can recall that the machinations of history, as we look back on the Middle Ages and the Inquisition and all kinds of things, it's super gnarly, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are talking about human nature being pretty much horrific as we look back on what befell all these various individuals who dared to say anything remotely against what was the doctrine of the church,
sure,
or whatever popular opinion was, you know, the idea of heresy, the idea of all these different ways that one could transgress, and what befell people who were actually now, of course, many of whom are lauded, vaunted, visionary heroes of science particularly.
Sure.
And also so many of these people were multidisciplinary. They were scientists, musicians, writers, painters. They did everything. And they suffered because of humanity's and society's generally small minds or adherence to what one might term insane doctrine, like very small-minded and narrow-minded doctrine. And so that's the thing I want to keep in mind, is that we're actually in better shape than we ever were, but we cannot go back.
Right.
We cannot go backwards.
That's a perfect place to leave it. So,
okay.
Nels Klein, thank you so much. Wilco perform at Santa Fe Opera on September 26th, and we will, of course, be looking forward to that show. Have a great week at the Stone during
your
residency. Boy, I wish I was in New York for that. And,
I'm the luckiest man in show business.
I had a marginal note here. You know, do you wake up sometimes and look at your schedule and start to get a panic attack, or quite the opposite? You just live in your bliss. Mm. And fortunately, I think it's the latter.
Yeah, it is. The panic usually sets in when I have to learn somebody else's music.
There you go. That's the beauty of being
aside time.
That's the beauty of being being an improviser.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's like, you know, pretty soon somebody like Bobby Previtt or Ben Goldberg's going to put a bunch of music in front of me, and I'm going to be like,
yeah,
help. But it works out beautifully in the end, I hope. Yeah, well, but that's what a quality problem is that. You know,
exactly.
I mean, that's ridiculous.
That's right.
And no, things are great.
Yeah.
Things are great.
Yes. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time, and we'll look forward to the show in September.
I love Santa Fe. I'll see you then.
Okay. Take care.
Okay. Thank
Bye-bye.
You again.
Bye-bye. Bye.